Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 382 of the podcast. And it's Friday, 22nd of June, 2018, as I record this early, as I am off to Spain for a yoga retreat. So I won't be recording while I am away. I will actually be back by the time this goes out, but wanted to get it out there so you have it to listen to. So today I'm talking about how to redesign your life to prioritize your writing with David Cadavy. And we talk about productivity, moving countries to live more cheaply. David tells us about Medellin in Colombia, which is definitely has a lot of people talking about it in the digital nomad space. And also we talk about how to make money writing on Steemit, which is a sort of blockchain community, which is all about micropayments and paying creators and those who work within the community. So I'm really excited about that. I think it's fascinating. David has written a book on it, and we talk about that towards the end, but lots of other things before then. So I hope you're going to enjoy that interview. So as I'm recording early, I don't have any news or anything to update, but I did want to say Happy Independence Day to Americans, and also wanted to encourage everyone to consider that word independence, because many of us are like, yay, I'm an indie author, but what does that actually mean? And I've been thinking back to when I lost my job in the financial crisis in 2008. Those of us who were part of the GFC remember that time with not much fondness. But what is interesting about that time is how many people went into entrepreneurship. I meet a lot of people in the podcasting space, the blogging space, who really got into what they do because of the GFC and the realization that you cannot be dependent on one source of income. So when I was laid off at that point, 100% of my income came from one source, which was my job. And suddenly that source was gone. And so my one stream of income disappeared. And I kind of pledged back then that I would never be reliant on one company again, that I would be truly independent and make as much as possible. Obviously, we all rely on lots of different things. For example, if the internet fell apart in the zombie apocalypse, I wouldn't be independent as much as anyone else. But what is interesting is so many indie authors who claim to be independent are not independent these days, gaining all their income from the Amazon ecosystem. And I've just done my end of year P&L statement, so my profit and loss for my company, and 13% of my income is from Amazon companies. So that includes KDP, CreateSpace, and ACX, Audible, audiobook stuff. So I actually think I'm quite happy with that. I mean, obviously, I love Amazon. I'm an Amazon customer. I'm Prime. I watch Amazon video. I have Amazon music. I have Kindle. We have one click delivery. And I even own shares in Amazon, but I do not want to let one company own me. And I've been passionate about this for a long time. As many of you know, I've always been, a proponent of wide. So if you're using Amazon as a way to invest your money in other things, so you don't have one stream of income, then awesome. Or if you have a job and you are just starting out and you don't want to leave your job, then awesome. But you can make some other money from different companies, then fantastic. But I'm quite happy that only 13% of my income is based on that. And I do make multiple streams of income from multiple sources. And someone asked me the other day, oh, but you know, you're not making all your money from your writing. And I actually get quite annoyed about this, because
why, when we write, what are the reasons we write? And I'm going on a bit of a rant now. I wasn't expecting to do this. But basically, when we write, if we're writing fiction, we're entertaining people. If we're writing nonfiction, we're educating and inspiring people. Those are the reasons why we write. So what if I can educate and inspire people just as much with this podcast than I can with a book? And in fact, I would go so far to say that I probably have touched more lives with the podcast than I have with my writing. Now, also, this podcast is turned into writing on my blog at The Creative Pen, and each show has show notes and a transcript of the interview that many people read. So a lot of people just read the transcript, so it is writing. I was talking to someone else about this around audio first books. So, you know, with books in quotation marks, because if a product is audio only, is that writing? If an author writes something that is performed as audio only, is it writing? Is it making money with writing? I'm preparing this podcast from a written document that I've prepared in order to talk to you in a coherent manner. Which is slightly fading now because I've gone off script. But it's interesting because it starts as writing. It's going into your brain through my voice, and you might write something down because of it. So my income that's related to the podcast, the sponsorship, and all you wonderful Patreon supporters, that is based on my writing. It's based on writing something in preparation. It's based on turning it into a transcript, and the outcome is the same. You know, training courses, and I'm doing more courses because people have so many questions. You know, these are writing too. I prepare all my material through writing it. So I just want everyone to kind of start thinking broader. You know, my blog has millions of words on at this point, and it is the words on my blog that drive the income that comes driven by, say, Google traffic. So all of these are words. The question is whether those words are written by hand, by computer, by voice into transcription. So I want you to start thinking that the multiple streams of income from multiple sources includes things like podcasting, audio, which is just going nuts. I mean, it really is. As well as, yeah, what if you write a script and then it gets made into a movie? That's still writing. So I want you to just broaden your mind as to what making a living with your writing might be, and as we move into Independence Day. So that was my, I'm just taking it back to where I started there. So that's my challenge for you. Write down how many income streams do you have right now? Do you have multiple streams of income? Can you really define yourself as independent? And of course, I've given you lots of ideas on this show over the years. And if you need any more ideas, check out How to Make a Living with Your Writing. I've also done stuff on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/thecreativepen. So go forth and be truly independent for the second half of the year. So today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I'll play a word from our sponsor in a minute. Thanks to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. You really mean so much to me. I hope you know it. I just value the support of the show so much. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And you can support the show and get the extra monthly Q&A for just a couple of dollars a month. And you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, here's a word from our sponsor, and then we'll get on with the interview.
Hey, Creative Pen listeners, I'm Chrissy, the director of Kobo Writing Life, Kobo's free self-publishing platform created by authors for authors.
And I'm Stephanie. I work on our publisher operations team.
We're just guessing here, but you seem to like podcasts for writers.
Did you know that we also have a podcast for writers?
It is the Kobo Writing Life podcast. We feature interviews with best-selling authors, tips on the craft and business of writing, and advice for successfully self-publishing.
In recent episodes, we talked to BookBub and asked them the number one question everyone wants to know. What are BookBub editors looking for when they choose titles to be featured in their deals emails?
And we interviewed USA Today best-selling author Serena Bowen about running a successful self-publishing business, collaborating with other authors, and the view of romance books in the media.
And most recently, we spoke to Overdrive about what librarians are looking for when buying ebooks.
So check us out.
The Kobo Writing Life Podcast.
Available for download on all major podcast platforms.
Today, I'm here with David Cadavy. Hi, David.
Hello, Joanna. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. David is a creative entrepreneur, a best-selling author, and podcaster. His books include Design for Hackers and The Heart to Start, Win the Inner War, and Let Your Art Shine. And he also has several mini books for creators, which we will talk about. So David, just start by telling us a bit more about you and how you got into writing.
Sure. I assume that this is a little different than it is for a lot of your listeners in that I never wanted to be a writer. In fact, as I was a kid, I hated writing. I thought it was the most boring thing that anybody could possibly do. I actually vividly remember reading something from Stephen King where he was saying, oh, when I was a child, I was on fire to write. And I remember seeing that. And I said to my brother, like, that's ridiculous. Who likes to write? It's the most boring thing anybody could possibly do. And he said, well, you know, the way that you feel about drawing, that's how he feels about writing. And so that was my thing. I was really into drawing. I was really into art. I studied graphic design in college. I went and worked in Silicon Valley as a web designer. Somewhere along the line there, I started writing voluntarily on a blog. And then somewhere along the line there, I wrote a blog post. It was popular. I had a couple of, not just one, but two book deal offers in my inbox from that blog post. And so so for some reason, I decided, okay, yeah, I'll do this. I'll write a book. And I think some people in my life were maybe a little worried that I would get like a writer's block or something like that. And I thought, well, I've done creative work before. I've certainly been blocked doing that. If I get writer's block, that's no problem. I can get through that. So I went ahead and wrote that first book. Design for Hackers is the first one, and it did well. But it was a process that I didn't want to repeat because I made myself very miserable writing that book because I did get blocked. But because I didn't have any idea how to handle it, the only way I knew how to handle it was to simply lock myself in my apartment for 6 months and cut out my entire social life and just spend 12 hours a day banging my head against the wall to get 15 minutes of flow and then get up and do it the next day. And it was, you know, I cut out my social life. It was the worst winter in like Chicago history. And it was a really miserable experience. So as I came out of that experience of writing that book, oddly, though, I still felt like I definitely am going to want to do this again. I'm one of these people who I think, like a lot of your listeners, really feels the need to create. Like, I don't feel right if I'm not putting something out there. And it turned out that writing was this new medium that, for me, new medium that I knew I was going to want to do it again, but I couldn't do it that way. So that's where I started to get more interested in sort of the emotional aspects of making your creative work happen. And sort of the creative productivity aspects of it. So that's how I ended up kind of doing the things that I'm doing these days.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? Because you said you started with blogging. I think blogging is almost, it's like a deceptive way in, especially for people who might be more confident with websites and graphic stuff, because it's almost like you're not writing, because and especially there's no rules like there is in creating a big book, like an important book. Mm-hmm. And you've recently put a blog post up about 24 things you learned about publishing in publishing 3 books in 6 months. And you talk a lot about this, like you don't have to write this big important book. So can you just talk a bit about how your publishing life has changed as well from that? And, you know, why things are so different now? Like, why are things not miserable?
Right. So the amount of time between my first book and my second book was 6 years. The amount of time between my second book and my fourth book, and I'm using the word book a little loosely because we can get into how short some of those books are, that was 6 months. And so I really had a huge shift in my approach to the idea of publishing and what is a book and stuff. And I think one of my big catalysts for that was I had a conversation with Seth Godin on my podcast a little more than a year ago. And he really drove home the point that, you know, if you're going to be publishing a book, you're going to be head of marketing for your book. So you need to learn how to do that. And to do that, you just keep on cranking out books and you always have something new that you can learn. And so that was really a revelation for me, especially because I got so lucky with my first book. It was just, you know, I wrote a blog post and a book deal falls on my lap. And then on top of it, people actually wanted to read that book. So there was a little bit of not only assuming that I could kind of go ahead and do the same thing and expect the same results, when in fact I was quite fortunate the first time around. But then there was also, how do I follow up this success of, you know, like my first book was top 20 on all of Amazon on launch day, did very well for a book in its category, did pretty well for any book, as a standard for any book. But then I just got so scared about putting that second book out there. So I think that conversation with Seth really helped me change my mindset as far as getting books out there and trying to enjoy the process as well. Mm-hmm. It's like seeing it as a journey, that each book that you put out, you have something new that you learn, and the things that you learn doing this book make that next book so much better. Mm. So that's the way I'm thinking about it more now.
Yeah. So relaxing into it a bit and just, you know, I guess not taking it seriously, but not taking it so seriously that it becomes this massive, insurmountable thing. So The Heart to Start talks a lot about facing up to this mental programming and fears. Mm. You talk a lot about fears and anxieties. And I know that resonates with a lot of my audience, because mindset is something that we all struggle with. So what were the other sort of programming issues that you tackled in terms of mind programming, and how did you change some of that?
Sure. And first of all, I'm surprised kind of to hear that your listeners can relate to that, because it seems like your listeners are such accomplished authors and they have so many books coming out that they're kind of like past this thing. But I mean, for me, it's a continual struggle. It's especially something that I struggled with very early on. And as far as like mental programming or deprogramming that mental programming, I think for me, the biggest thing was just recognizing that you can make whatever you want, that you can make whatever you want. Because when I was a kid, I wasn't surrounded by people who were authors or who were entrepreneurs. You know, if I read a book or played a video game or watched a movie, it never dawned on me like, oh, real people, just like my neighbor or my parents, made these things. I could make something like that. Mm-hmm. So simply just understanding that that it was a possibility to make things, I think, was the biggest thing for me. Now, how has that happened? It's happened very slowly and accidentally, just kind of doing one little thing after another before I start to realize, like whatever fantasies I might have in my head about something that I could do, I could actually go ahead and do that. Now, it's still scary. So how can I kind of find the little handholds to get the leverage to pull myself out of whatever it is that is holding me back from doing those things? And that's a lot of what I explored in The Heart to Start, which is a book really all about how there is this advice of just get started, which I think is really fantastic advice, except for it's very difficult to follow. Mm-hmm. Whenever somebody told me that, I was always left wondering, well, what do I start with? How do I start? And what about all these terrible things that could happen? And so that book was my exploration of how to actually start in a way that is effective, not only for other people, but and not only for my 25-year-old self, but also for my present self, because I often find myself getting caught up in the same mental or emotional traps all the time. And I remember remember I wrote this thing about how to handle this. And one, I should be consistent with this stuff that I wrote. So it's kind of using cognitive dissonance to my own advantage. Mm-hmm. But it's also, I've formalized these things. So I actually have a handbook for myself to follow, to actually move forward and create the work that I want to create.
That's so funny because I have exactly the same thing with the successful author mindset, which, you know, I read my own chapters and I'm like, yeah, listen to yourself. This is what you should be. You should recognize this is part of the process and it happens every time. And you have to go through that part. It is a cycle. And reflecting on what Seth said or what people like Stephen Pressfield say, you know, this creative process, it has these stages and you can't, it's not like you can skip any of those stages. And one of the stages is fear and anxiety. And it seems to happen wherever you are on the journey, unless perhaps you're a sociopath.
Yeah. And if you are, then hey, go for it.
But seriously, every time I talk about fear and anxiety and self-doubt on the show, it's what people go, oh my goodness, I feel that. And that point where you look at your book and go, oh, this is terrible. But do you think that part of this, it's interesting, this again, this iterative process, like because you spent time in Silicon Valley doing web design, no web designer or Silicon Valley programmer will sit down and create a perfect thing straight off. Do you think that the lessons of online can transfer into the book world in that way? Oh,
absolutely. I think this is a great kind of advantage that I've had is that I've gone through that creative struggle. And yeah, you're right. You don't sit down and make an interface for a web app in one go. I mean, you try, especially early on, you try and you're wondering, why is this so hard? But then eventually you realize there's these different starting to emerge in things like UX design. There's different sort of methodologies or processes that you can follow that will cull out those little pieces that you need to put together into something cohesive and make that creative work happen. And so I think that is definitely an advantage because in design, it's a little more tangible. You have a sketch on a paper and eventually you're going to turn it into maybe a mock-up, and then eventually it's going to be code, and it's not even going to be static code. It's going to be dynamic code. You know, it's going to be like the application is going to be drawing all this stuff. But when you're writing and you write a couple words and you're like, oh, this is awful. And it's on the screen. It's in like nice, clean typography as if it's in a book or something. And you're thinking, well, why is it so bad? How is it ever going to look like this thing in the book? And they look so similar. I feel like it's more difficult to internally understand that there really is a process that needs to happen underneath all of this that is invisible, that, you know, you need to actually look inside and explore what's going on with you emotionally and what sort of questions you have in your brain and collect those things and let them incubate and then put them together into something that is cohesive and makes sense and is a book. You know, that the people open the pages and are like, oh, this is a book and I'm reading it and it's comfortable and I enjoy it. So to get to that process is definitely not straightforward.
It's interesting. I think you've hit the nail on the head there about the fact is with writing, what you put on the screen is what does look like the book. Whereas when you're programming, and I have some programming experience, it doesn't look like it. And or on a blog, you go to the HTML and it's not the same. So that's a really good point. And I think when editing, I print out when I edit in by hand. And so it kind of looks different to what I saw on the screen. But hopefully some people listening will find that helpful. But I wanted to ask you, at the beginning of Heart to Start, you say that you, quote, redesigned your life to make writing your top priority and ended up quadrupling your writing output. Now, everyone listening now wants that, and me included. So can you give us some tips? So how did you redesign your life to make writing your top priority? That's a big statement.
Sure. First of all, it was a couple of years ago. I was on a retreat in Mexico and I was spending a lot of time with some friends of mine. And we take a whole week and we really explore like what's going on in our life. What are we doing now? What do we want to do in the future? And it took me a while to like come to terms with this thing. Like I really want to double down on writing. I want to explore things that are interesting to me and share what I learn along the way. And oh no, this is going to be difficult. And so part of that, of making that happen, was I moved to Colombia. And, you know, I think like a designer in a way that it, if you're a designer and you have a problem that you're trying to solve or an objective that you're trying to meet, such as you want to double down on writing, you want to make it as a writer, well, then you've got to move things around in a way that's going to help meet that objective. And so one way to do that, or a principle that's very common in design, is the idea of it's constraints. So constraints that are behavior shaping constraints. So, you know, moving to Columbia is one behavior shaping constraint, because it makes me less likely to say, oh, yeah, I'm just going to go to New York for the weekend, or oh, I will totally accept this unpaid speaking gig or something like that. You know, and so looking for those constraints in all parts of my life. So one of those is having a morning routine, which is a great constraint, because first of all, the morning is the best time to get any sort of thing done. I think about the airport of O'Hare, where I used to live in Chicago, is notorious. It's a notorious airport because it has a ton of delays. But it only has a ton of delays if you fly out, you know, sometime after 10 a.m. Mm-hmm. You know, so if it's 6 a.m. or 8 a.m., all of the chaos that causes delays, all that stuff hasn't had a chance to get in the way. The same thing is true of your life. You know, depending on your lifestyle, you know, if you have children, it might be a little bit different. But, you know, you get up in the morning, things haven't gotten a chance to get in the way. So let's do the most important thing. So really making a habit out of writing, which was something I was totally against before. I used to be one of these people who was just like, oh, whenever I'm inspired, I'll do it. I don't want to force writing. It's not going to be as good if I do that. So I really questioned that belief and started making a habit. And most importantly, a small habit, because I think when I had tried before, I would make a habit of, say, I'm going to write 1,000 words a day. What happens when you say that you're going to write 1,000 words a day when you're not a super experienced writer? What happens is you write 1,000 words, and then the next day you write 1,000 words, and then the next day you oversleep your alarm, or, you know, your oatmeal gets mushy or something. You make some excuse about why you can't do your habit on this day. And so I just try to be easy on myself. I'm like, let's just string it together. You know, like this morning was a morning where I wasn't really able to get in a huge 2-hour writing session that I typically do now. But, you know, I took 15 minutes and, you know, I got quite a bit of writing done in that amount of time. And so making a habit of it. And then as far as word output, actually making a shipping habit as well, where I was shipping a 500 word post on Medium every single day for quite a while. And, you know, a lot of them were really bad, but something happens after a little while, you do it enough. And suddenly one day you wake up and, like, you can see a 500 word post in your brain. Like, you can see the whole thing and you can write it, and it ends up being good, and it ends up getting noticed, and it ends up getting picked up by publications and stuff. And so that was a really, really a surprise to me, that if I force myself to write, and it's much easier to force yourself to write when you have that habit, because it becomes harder to not do your habit than it becomes to do your habit, then things start to happen. And so that's, yeah, I did measure my word output from 1 year to the next, and it was 4x, and things were happening with my writing too. So that's when things were getting picked up, and I was, you know, starting to, you know, get my second book out and stuff. And so those things really, really help, is finding those constraints that'll make it easy for you to do the thing that you want to do, and hard for you to do the things that are going to prevent you from doing that thing.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And you do have a tips list on your website. So we'll do a call to action at the end for that, which is fantastic. Sure. But one of the, I want to come back to the Columbia thing, because there's people going, what? He moved to Columbia? Like, what the hell?
Not a city, not the university in New York, the country, Columbia.
Yeah. So tell us why Columbia, and any sort of lessons learned about moving to quite a different culture.
Well, I told you a little earlier about, you know, how when I wrote my first book, it was the worst winter, like, in Chicago history. So after that happens, I decided I wanted to treat myself. And so the next winter I said, all right, I'm going to go somewhere warm. And so I went to Buenos Aires for a couple of weeks. And then I was like, that worked out well. So the next year, the next natural destination was Colombia, just because, I don't know, I had heard about it, you know, this place called Medellin and how it's the city of the eternal spring and everything. And so I went, and that was 5 years ago. And I came back like every 6 months. And, you know, 2 years ago, I moved here full time. Mm-hmm. So it turned out to be a really great place to do creative work and be a writer. I noticed, and this is something your listeners can try, is if they have done an extended trip somewhere or they've done work somewhere else or in some sort of environment, is like, look at the work that you did while you were there. And that was something that I noticed as I looked at work. You know, I was rereading an article of mine that I had written while I was spending a couple months in Colombia. And I was like, you know, this is some of my best work. Mm. Why is that? Oh, because I'm just happier in this place. And so I never did go spend another winter in Chicago. And last winter I spent there was 2010. And so now I've been in Colombia for 2 years. Medellin is great for me. It's the city of the eternal spring. It's roughly room temperature all year round. The sun rises and sets at the same time. So these are things that make it so you can really get into a routine. You don't, you're not like going through these seasonal disruptions, which can be great for your creativity at sometimes, but they are disruptive to having any sort of consistent output. And so I'm able to really get into a rhythm, have my morning routine. I can go outside. I don't have to worry about what I'm going to wear. And I can have a nice, a very healthy sleep schedule because the sun rises and sets at the same time. You don't have these things where it's dark at 3 p.m. or it's light at 10 p.m. Mm. You know, like it sure happens in Bath. And so there's those things. And then there's also the disconnection from your work. I in the research or reading that I've done about creativity and what makes great creative work happen, you find time and time again that disconnecting from a problem allows it to incubate and then results in a better solution later on or a quicker, easier solution later on. Mm-hmm. Now, that's difficult to do in a place, a driven place like Chicago, where everybody's very career oriented and everybody's go, go, go all the time. It kind of makes it kind of hard to relax. So a place like Colombia is great because the culture really values the present moment. They value spending time with friends and family. And so it's just way more laid back. So when I get out of my routine of writing and I go outside, I'm in this more laid back environment. Plus, after being in this mental world of English all day long, I go out into the world and suddenly I have to switch to a different language. Mm. So while it's a little mentally very challenging. It helps me disconnect from that work. You know, like my girlfriend and I only speak Spanish to each other. She doesn't speak English, you know? So I'm like operating in a completely different language and headspace when I'm not working. And I feel like that disconnection helps me with my writing. It's one of these things that I've seen Hemingway write about, is like, you do your writing session, and then until your next writing session, you wait and you don't think about writing. How do you not think about writing? Well, you just don't do it.
That's so interesting. You know, talking of Hemingway, we've just come back from Spain and we were talking, yeah, like saying, oh goodness, you know, maybe we should move to Spain. You know, we really like that kind of, we'll have to come visit you in Medellin.
Please do.
Yeah, but it's interesting because that is one of the cities that people talk about now that has become quite a digital nomad-y type space.
Yes.
But obviously we're not on a digital nomad podcast. So before we finish with that, are there any resources that you can point people to if they're interested in Medellin or Colombia or digital nomadism type thing?
I would say I can only think of the things that I've written. Suddenly
that's fine.
I've written a post about mini lives, which was sort of my philosophy of living in a place for a couple months at a time and getting a feel for what it was like to live there, which was what led to me moving here full time. That's on Observer. There's a sort of a how-to post about how to manage the logistics of something like that on my blog, Katavi.net. If you search for Mini Lives, Katavi and Observer, or find the Katavi.net link for those two respective ones, you'll find things there. I also recommends, if you are fantasizing about going and living someplace, go on Facebook, find the expat board. There's an expat group for whatever town it is that you are thinking about living in, and join that group and look around. Now, I will say that you're always going to find a little bit more negativity than is actually exists, because somehow these expat groups on Facebook attract that attention. But so just that caveat, but you'll find all sorts of really valuable information. You know, you're wondering about, oh, I've got kids that they need to go to school, or what sort of schooling options are there? Like, somebody has already had that discussion if you use the little search tool in the Facebook group. And so just doing that can really get you going. I would also recommend one thing that helps is to just get on Google Earth and go visit the place, you know, and walk around on the streets. You know, it kind of gets you into that state that can propel you forward to actually making it happen.
Fantastic. And it's funny, I mean, I've moved countries a lot, but to very similar cultures, and I don't speak Spanish yet, but you know, I say yet, which is hilarious.
Still to come.
But I am married, and I do think pillow talk can really help with your language learning. So I'll just have to get my husband into Spanish first. But okay, let's talk about your publishing choices, because you designed for Hackers, published by Wiley, very respected publisher, did very well for you. Now you're indie. So what are your thoughts on publishing choices for authors these days, and why are you choosing your path?
You know, I sort of feel like I didn't have a choice. Like, I did have that first book with Wiley, and when it came time to write another book, I didn't feel like it wasn't going to be a fit for Wiley. And so, interestingly, I slowly came to the realization that I didn't actually know how to get a book published, you know? So I read some resources. I did the whole thing going through Publishers Marketplace and looking for the right agent and doing a ton of market research, trying to figure out the positioning of the book and which agent would be right for it. And I wrote the proposal, spent months on that, and sent it out to some agents, and then really lukewarm response. You know, nobody was jumping on it. And that was crushing. Like, I assumed that this would be easy, you know, as if I can say it, a best-selling author, which so many of us are.
Certainly on this podcast.
Yeah, but you know, I thought it would be a lot easier. And so I kind of went back to the drawing board, and I did it again. And then again, kind of a lukewarm response. And what I slowly started to realize was that as I was writing these proposals and as I was thinking about what these agents wanted to see and what publishers were publishing, I came to the realization that it wasn't a good fit for me. You know, I think more and more, this might be even becoming more true, is that traditional publishers are looking for traditional authority triggers. You know, they're looking for, you are a Stanford professor, or you are a journalist at a prestigious publication, you were CEO of this Fortune 500 company, because that sells books at the scale that is required to support the traditional publishing industry. And the more and more I thought about it, the more and more I felt pressured to try to find those authority triggers in myself, which there aren't. You know, I didn't go to an Ivy League school. I didn't work at a big corporation. These things, I started to realize, like, oh, that's not me. I've never wanted any of those things. I don't go for those things. I like to figure things out for myself. And so while I do hear a lot of stories about people who get dozens and dozens of rejections, I didn't get a ton of rejections, but it was just enough for me to say, you know what, I'm just going to figure this out for myself. And because I just got impatient. It had been almost 6 years since my previous book came out. I was starting to feel like I didn't deserve to exist, you know, like, it's just what it feels like when you aren't creating things. And there's, you know, I need to get something out there. Now, but what I found, though, in the process of doing the indie publishing was not only that I knew very little about how to make it happen, and I knew very little about how to really sell the books and market them, even though I had done it all before, but this was a different thing where you have to make people care. But I also realized that, oh, I have all the skills that I need to be my own publishing house. Now, I know that you're not big on the self-publishing name. We talked about that on my podcast. You're more into indie publishing, but I'm literally a self-publisher. I do the writing. I do all the page layout because I'm a designer.
You're a designer. That's different. Yeah, if you're a designer, you can do that stuff.
I do the HTML and CSS to code the Kindle version, the ebook, which is super simple. If you know HTML and CSS are not that complicated of languages, and I've got marketing experience, and so I can do all those things. Now I did get help from my readers on editing. I crowd edited using Google Docs. So I did get help there. So maybe I am indie and not self-published. I should not give myself so much credit. But that was a really wonderful feeling to start laying out my book or to lay out the Kindle version of the book and to look at it and realize like, oh, this is exactly what a traditional published book looks like. And I'm able to sort of make those smoke and mirrors, which, let's face it, that's kind of what they are, is there's smoke and mirrors on some words that, you know, they could be just typed on a typewriter and not look so fancy, and they might have a little less impact. But, you know, you get the design going on it, and suddenly it's like, wow, this is a book. And so that was a really amazing feeling to realize that I had the skills to do it and that the tools are out there to do this. And the only thing that had been standing in my way all this time was my own ego, was that, you know, I had this first book that was successful. This next one has to be more successful, or, you know, the next one's got to be like a New York Times bestseller, or all these, I realize now, like, delusional ideas that I had that were really more than anything, just holding my work inside of me and keep preventing me from making my next book real. Mm-hmm. And so that is how I arrived at this whole self-publishing adventure. And, you know, I can't say that if I did find a good traditionally published deal that I wouldn't do it, but I'm glad to know that I have the option. Mm. And I'm also glad to know that if something like that were to happen, I would have some negotiating leverage that way. You know, we spend so much time really asking for permission to do something that we don't need permission to do.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, to put a book out there. Like, we don't need permission to do that. But here we are, like, groveling to the gatekeepers, asking them to pick us. And if we have nothing to show to make them want to pick us, then what negotiating leverage do we have? None. But if we already know how to write books and sell books and publish them ourselves, then they can see that. And suddenly we have some leverage in the game, because if you can sell books, they want to sell books too. So
yeah, no, it's true.
Learn how to sell books.
Yeah, regardless. And if you get a deal, you still have to sell your own books. So, I mean, that's just the way it goes. But it's interesting because, and the final thing I want to ask you about, so one of these short books that you've been writing, and something that you might not have got permission so as to do, because you've put it out so fast, is mm-hmm. Make Money Writing on the Steam Blockchain. Now,
what does that mean?
I know. And everyone's like, oh no, she's talking about blockchain again. So I've talked about blockchain. I've interviewed some people about blockchain technology, so we don't need to get too technical, but and of course you have a book about making money writing on the Steam blockchain. But it says Steam It is a fundamental shift in how writing is monetized, and that sounds exciting. So can you talk, just give us a high level sort of your thoughts on the Steam blockchain?
High level, I will try very hard. Yes, it's a very niche book. I was super excited to find Steam or Steam It or blockchain backed social media, because there's a big problem in media, especially that I've seen working in Silicon Valley or starting my own media companies and being a writer, is that, let's just use this as an example. When you're writing, when you're using Facebook, you are working for Facebook. Mm. Facebook has no value without what you contribute to it. So whether that is an article that you write, or you like something, which is a signal that this is good content, or you comment on something, you add to the discussion, or you talk about in the group about, you know, how you get a visa in the expat group. And Facebook is worthless without that. But it's so collective. There's so many people contributing to it. And so how could they possibly reward people for their contributions? They are what you've probably heard is the centralized model. They have a database. They control the database. And our enjoyment of Facebook alone, or whatever we can squeeze out of the eyeballs that we can get off of Facebook, is our compensation for what we contribute to Facebook. It would be infeasible, impossible for Facebook, using traditional banking systems, to pay people for their contributions all around the world. I mean, it would just be a complete mess. So the way that blockchain works, and I'll try to just not get too far into the details with it, is that you can reward people for their contributions. So the same way people have heard that computers push power to this network and that mines Bitcoin, actions that you take on Steemit, much like actions you would take on Facebook, commenting, sharing something, liking something, upvoting it, all of that is mining a cryptocurrency. Now, why does that cryptocurrency have any value? Because you can use it to promote things. If you have a lot of cryptocurrency, you earn more cryptocurrency. It gives you more influence in the network. And then there's also, aside from that, and this is something that a lot of the cryptocurrencies out there only have this component, which is the speculative investors on the outside. So there's all this virtuous cycle stuff going on that make these tokens worth something. And these tokens are distributed as people take actions on this network. So I have earned $4,000 so far. I've cashed it out into US dollars of this cryptocurrency. My account is worth, I don't know, another four or five. It goes up and down depending upon the cryptocurrency. And that might not sound like a lot of money. That might sound like a lot of money. But the cool thing is nobody paid me a dime to read my writing. It was all the fruits of the collective project that is Steemit being distributed to all the people who are contributing to it. So I think of it this way, that Facebook is digital sharecropping. Steemit is the community garden where you get to eat the vegetables, but you also get to take them to the farmer's market and sell them off and make a little bit of money on the side.
Yeah, so, and it's when you were talking, I think it clicked a bit more. So this is why they call it Steemit, but it seems like all the people doing stuff are like lots of little people running, and it's kind of moving the train, right? It generates steam that moves the train. Is that kind of an analogy?
Yeah, I think that it is that, because it's at least recognizing that these sites, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or YouTube, they're community projects. It is the greatest community project in the history of humanity. And who's reaping all the benefits? I mean, when I say all the benefits, I'm exaggerating, but it is these centralized companies who, you know, deserve deserve compensation for the amazing things that they've created. Do they deserve so much compensation? Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is the problem with the model. And so something like Steemit is decentralized, meaning that there's not some one entity that's controlling everything. And it allows the value to flow a lot more freely. And so that's one reason that I was so excited about it, that even though hardly anybody wants to read a book about Steemit, I had to put this thing out there because I'm that excited about it.
I am too. And it does seem like, and I agree with you, Google and Facebook and Amazon, they deserve the success they have had. But it's like everyone is reaching a point of this. It turns into a monopoly in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a monopoly, but, you know, there's all those words. But it is very locked up in these big companies, and Steemit and other blockchain stuff. It seems slow in coming, like it is. Yeah. Very much. I mean, in your circles, in the Silicon Valley circles, some of your friends are much more into this. But most of the, like many authors are only just discovering WordPress. that we are, it's a slow niche in terms of technology. But so what do you see, like 10 years ago, there was no Kindle, there was no iPhone. Well, we're just over the 10-year mark. Do you see in 10 years, we will be publishing distributed on the blockchain, we will be monetizing through Steam, and things will have changed? Or will Amazon and Google and that lot have their own blockchains and keep it sewn up?
First, I'll acknowledge that this stuff is very complicated and can be, you can listen to it and say, like, this will never catch on because it's so hard to understand. But for anybody who says that, I say go on YouTube and search for the Good Morning America hosts trying to understand the internet in like 1993. You got Brian Gumbel and Katie Couric. Like, what's the internet? So does it work? You know, and humans as a group can learn things. Now, to your question about will we be publishing on the blockchain, or are these, I think it's oligopies, right?
Like, yeah, whatever they
control
are.
Everything. I personally would be very surprised if that didn't happen, if we didn't start publishing on the blockchain. Now, I obviously have no way of knowing, but I feel like I've seen some technological shifts in my life, and I feel very confident that not necessarily Steam or Steemit, you know, it's the idea behind Steam or Steemit, it or something like it will, I think, monetize a lot of things. I mean, we're seeing things with blockchain where, you know, you can buy a share of your musician's songs, and you're going to get paid a share of the royalties that when they're using the blockchain for that. I mean, I feel like that's kind of a short-sighted idea. Or there's a browser like Brave where you can buy basic attention tokens, and they're blocking ads all the time, but they're distributing these tokens to all the site operators at the sites that you visit. And so we're starting to see all these different ways of approaching it. And it's really just the idea of how can we get value to flow from one place to another without all these choke points of, oh, well, you're in this country and I need to pay you some money. So I'm going to send it to the bank, and then it's going to take 3 to 5 days. Your bank is going to have to check with my bank to like make sure that the money is actually being shifted. Like all these very slow things, when with blockchain or cryptocurrency, you can transfer something pretty much immediately, whether it is actually a cryptocurrency or it's just another line in the ledger of this happened. We can be confident that this happened because it's not sitting on a server that some company controls. It's a shared database that computers around the world are checking with one another to make sure that this thing happened and that can't be changed. And so there's so many different ways that could play out. And I could totally see something like some sort of e-reader that has that's blockchain backed. And I also see it as blockchain can allow readers, your fans, to get in on it too a little bit, because that's part of the problem or the paradox that there is with information right now is nobody wants to read information unless they know it's good. They can't read the information unless they read it, and they're not going to read it. They're not going to pay to read it, you know, unless they already know that you're great. So the blockchain sort of breaks that down. And then also, if you are a fan and you like something, like you say, so you listen to my podcast and you share it with a friend, well, don't you deserve a little something? I think so. I think you deserve a little piece of the pie. And I could see how there could be a tokenized system where you're kind of getting a little piece of whatever it is that's being distributed in a blockchain environment of books or something like that. So hopefully that's not like too far out there, but that's a little bit of what's going on in my head. I still need to think it through myself.
Oh, yeah. And I think everyone's thinking this through. You know, I've heard things, people talking about universal credit ideas where it's based on your behavior, you know, or even your data or your DNA or what you share becomes monetized in some way, because that's the future of what we won't be doing physical work or whatever. So I think what we're talking about, it feels like a 10-year shift. It feels like another internet type of thing. Like, it's a big shift, but so many things are broken with the whatever they are, the big companies, that this is great. So we can't go into this in any more detail, but your book, Make Money Writing on the Steam Blockchain, is fantastic. And I advise people to go and check it out if they are interested in that topic. So we need to finish now. We could talk forever, you and I think, but tell people just a little bit about your podcast and where they can find you and your books and everything you do online.
Sure. Yeah, my podcast is called Love Your Work. It is a podcast where I talk to creative entrepreneurs, people like Joanna Penn or Seth Godin, and I find out, you know, how is it that they found this path that is so uniquely theirs? And so they can go ahead and listen to that podcast anywhere they find podcasts. They can also find it at catavy.net/podcast. Of course, there's an interview up there with Joanna if people would like to hear me interview her. And other than that, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram at Catavy, Catavy author on Facebook. And then, of course, I've got all my books on Amazon, and The Heart to Start is wide. So it's pretty much you can get it anywhere.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, David. That was great.
Great. Thank you so much.
So I hope you found the interview with David interesting today. What can you do to prioritize your writing for the rest of the year ahead? Now, next week, I'll be talking about tips for editing your book with Natasha Lekic from New York Book Editors, who are fantastic. And Natasha is amazing. We really got on very, very well, which I love when that happens with a guest. We have a great chat about what editors really do, why they can be an investment in your writing future, especially at the beginning, and how you can improve your manuscript before you send it to an editor. Plus, thoughts on creativity and ambition, which is something very close to my heart and also Natasha's as creative entrepreneurs running our own businesses in the creative space. So I hope you'll find that interesting. Have a wonderful writing week, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes, available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.